cinema in America would be part of a sting operation. But what if Paul's movies were real? Agents from the FBI didn't just show up at burglaries for no reason. When Julia first went missing, Helen and Sam had raised hell trying to get the FBI involved. But it was explained to them that, by law, a state agency had to request federal help before the feds could review the case. Given that the sheriff thought Julia had run off in a fit of rebellion, there had been no request sent up the chain. Claire opened the web browser and pulled up the FBI's homepage. She went to the FAQs. She scrolled through questions about all the various crimes the agency investigated until she found what she was looking for. Computer-related crime. In the national security area, the FBI investigates criminal matters involving the nation's computerized banking and financial systems. Examples of criminal acts would be using a computer to commit fraud or using the internet to transmit obscene material. Claire had no doubt these movies were obscene. Maybe she'd been right about Agent Fred Nolan yesterday. The FBI had tracked the downloaded files to Paul's computer. Claire had seen a 60 Minutes story where a government whistleblower had said connecting your computer to the internet was tantamount to jacking yourself directly into the NSA. They probably knew that Paul had looked at the movies. Which meant they knew that Claire was looking at them, too. Jesus! The Mac was hardwired to the internet. She grabbed at the cords plugged into the back of the computer. She yanked on the cable so hard that the monitor twisted around. Thin wires stripped away from the plastic plug, severing the internet connection. Claire nearly passed out with relief. Her heart was beating so hard that she could feel it in her neck. Her parole officer had made it clear that he would send her to jail for even the smallest violation. Was it illegal to look at these movies? Had Claire broken the law without even realizing? Or had she overreacted like an idiot? She turned the monitor back around. All of the web pages said she was not connected to the internet. The movies were still frozen on screen. Another error message had popped up. Warning. Disk Gladiator not properly ejected. Some files may have been lost. Claire looked at all the cables she had unplugged. She wasn't completely ignorant about computers. She knew that movie files were large and required a lot of storage. She knew that the lightning symbol on the back of the computer was for a Thunderbolt connection, which transferred data twice as fast as USB. She also knew her husband. Claire knelt down on the floor. Paul had designed his desk so that all the cables were concealed inside. Everything electrical, from the computer to the desk lamp, connected into a battery backup tucked inside the desk. She knew the large black box was the battery backup because Paul had labeled it Battery Backup. She pulled out the drawers and checked inside and behind them. There didn't appear to be an external hard drive inside the desk. The power cord for the backup was concealed inside the front right desk leg. The plug came out at the bottom and connected to a floor outlet. Nothing was labeled Gladiator. Claire pushed on the desk. Instead of the whole thing rolling straight back, it went lopsided, like an excited dog wagging its entire butt. There was another cable threaded through another leg. It was white and thin, the same as the Thunderbolt cable that she'd yanked out of the back of the computer. That end was still on top of the desk. The other end disappeared into a hole drilled into the hardwood floor. She went downstairs into the garage. Paul's Gladiator workbench took up an entire wall. Smaller rolling cabinets with drawers were on either side with an open span of about 10 feet in between. Claire pulled out all of the cabinets. No stray cables trailed from the back of the drawers. She looked underneath the bench. Claire had driven into the garage thousands of times, but she'd never noticed that the diamond plate paneling behind the bench wasn't the same paneling that was on the wall. She pressed against the metal and the sheet flexed under her hand. Claire stood up. Thanks to her tennis racket, Paul's 3D printer and CAD laser cutter were in pieces strewn across the bamboo worktop. She swept them onto the floor with her arm. She turned off the lights. She leaned over the workbench and looked down through the narrow crack between the bench and the wall. She started at the far left end. At what she knew was the exact center, she saw a flashing green light behind the workbench. She turned the lights back on. She found a flashlight in one of the rolling cabinets. The workbench was too heavy to move, and even without that, it was bolted to the floor. She leaned back over the bench and saw that the green flashing light was on a large, external hard drive. None of this was an accident. Claire couldn't come up with any good excuses. This setup had been designed into the house when it was built 8 years ago. Paul hadn't just watched those movies. He had collected them. And he had gone to great lengths to make sure that no one found them. Tears filled her eyes. Were the movies real? Could she possibly have evidence of the torture and killing of perhaps dozens of women? Yesterday, Fred Nolan had asked Claire about Paul's demeanor before he died. For the first time since it happened, Claire let herself consider what her own demeanor had been. She was shocked when Paul pulled her into that alley. Excited when he made it clear what he wanted to do. Thrilled when he'd been so forceful, because it was sexy and completely unexpected. And then what? Claire knew she'd been terrified when she realized they were being robbed. Had she been scared before that? When Paul spun her around and crushed her against the wall, hadn't she been a little afraid? Or was she revising her memory because the way he'd kicked her legs apart and pinned her wrists to the wall was oddly reminiscent of the spread-eagled young girls in the movies? Those poor creatures. If the movies were real, then Claire owed it to their families to do everything she could to make sure they knew what had happened to them. Or what might happen. Because there was the slim possibility that the young girl in the second movie was still alive. Claire moved quickly because she knew that if she stopped to think about it, she would do the wrong thing. Paul always bought two of everything for the computers. There was an extra 20-terabyte hard drive in the garage basement. Claire leveraged the heavy box off the shelf and lugged it up to the office. She followed the directions to set up the drive using the computer, then she plugged in the Gladiator cable. She highlighted all of the files and dragged them to the new drive. "Do you want to copy Gladiator onto Lacey 5 Big?" Claire clicked yes. The rainbow wheel started spinning as the computer calculated the amount of time it would take to transfer all of the files. 54 minutes. She sat down at Paul's desk and watched the progress bar inching across the screen. Claire looked at the anniversary painting again. She thought about Paul as a child. She'd seen pictures. His winsome, toothy grin. The way his ears poked out from his giant head when he was 6 and 7. The way everything started to catch up when puberty hit. He wasn't dashing or flashy, but he was handsome once she'd talked him into wearing contacts and buying nice suits. And he was funny, and he was charming, and he was so damn smart that she just assumed he knew the answer to everything. If only he were here now to answer her questions about this. Claire's eyes blurred. She was crying again. She continued crying until the message came up that all the files had been successfully copied. A toppled cabinet was blocking her BMW. She drove Paul's Tesla because it was getting dark and the Porsche's headlights were shattered. Claire did not question herself about what she was doing until she pulled into the parking lot in front of the Dunwoody police station. The hard drive was belted into the seat beside her. The white aluminum box weighed at least 20 pounds. The passenger airbag had turned off because the sensors assumed a toddler was in the seat. Claire looked up at the police station, which resembled a 1950s office supply store. Fred Nolan was probably the person she should be giving this to, but yesterday, Nolan had been an asshole to Claire, and Mayhew had basically told him to shut the fuck up, so she was going to give it to Captain Mayhew. Did she trust him to take this seriously? Unlike Fred Nolan, Claire had not gotten a clear vibe off Captain Mayhew, other than to think that he looked like a cop out of Central Casting. His mustache had thrown her off because Sheriff Carl Huckabee, the original Huckleberry, had sported an impotent-looking mustache that he kept trimmed in a straight line, rather than grooming it to follow the natural curve of his upper lip. Claire had been 13 the first time she'd met the man. She could still recall looking up at the strange push-broom over his lip and wondering if it was fake. Which mattered not one bit in her current situation because facial hair was not a universal indicator of incompetency. She looked down at the hard drive in the seat beside her. Red pill, blue pill. Mayhew wasn't the concern here. It was Claire. It was Paul's reputation. There was no such thing as anonymity anymore. This would get out. People would know what her husband was into. Maybe people already did. And maybe the movies were real, which meant that the second girl might still be alive. Claire forced herself to get out of the car. The hard drive felt heavier than before. Night was falling fast. Thunder rumbled in the distance. The overhead lights came on as Claire walked across the parking lot. Her funeral dress had dried, but it was stiff and chafing. Her jaw hurt from grinding her teeth. The last time she was at the Dunwoody police station, she was in a tennis dress and being escorted in through the back doors. This time, she found herself in an extremely narrow front lobby with a large piece of bulletproof glass separating visitors from the office area. The receptionist was a burly man in uniform who didn't look up when Claire entered. She put the hard drive down on an empty chair. She stood in front of the window. The burly police officer reluctantly looked up from his computer.
"Who are you here to see?"
"Captain Mayhew." The name elicited an immediate frown.
"He's busy, ma'am."
Claire hadn't expected this. "I need to leave this for him." She pointed to the hard drive, wondering if it looked like a bomb. It sure as hell felt like one. "Maybe I can write a note explaining..."
"Lee, I got this."
Captain Mayhew was standing behind the glass. He waved for Claire to go to a side door. There was a buzzing sound, then the door opened. Instead of seeing just Mayhew, she found Mayhew and Adam Quinn.
"Claire."
Adam seemed tense.
"I didn't get that email."
"I'm sorry." Claire had no idea what he was talking about. "What email?"
"The work-in-progress file from Paul's laptop."
Paul's laptop. God only knew what he had on the MacBook. "I don't...
just get it to me."
Adam walked past her and out the door. She stared at his back long after he'd gone. She didn't understand why he seemed so angry. Mayhew told Claire,
"Guy does not like being in a police station."
Claire suppressed the first response that came to mind. "Who the hell does?" Mayhew said,
"We're talking to everybody who has a key to your house."
Claire had forgotten Adam was on the list. He and his wife Sheila lived five streets over. He checked on the house when Claire and Paul were out of the country. Mayhew asked,
"What can I do you for, Mrs. Scott?" I have something you need to see. She started to lift the hard drive.
I got that.
Obviously, he wasn't expecting the box to be so heavy, he almost dropped it.
Whoa! What is this thing?
It's a hard drive. Claire felt herself getting flustered. It was my husband's. I mean, my husband...
Let's go back to my office.
Claire tried to pull herself together as she followed him down a long corridor with closed doors on each side. She recognized the open area for processing prisoners. Then, there was another long corridor. Then they were in an open office space. There were no cubicles, just five desks with five men all hunched over their computers. Two rolling whiteboards were at the front of the room. All were filled with photographs and scribbled notes that were too far away to make out. Mayhew stopped outside his office door.
After you.
Claire sat down. Mayhew put the drive on his desk, then took a seat. She stared at him. More to the point, she stared at his mustache, so that she wouldn't have to look him in the eye. He asked,
Do you want something to drink? Water? Coke?
No, thank you. Claire couldn't drag this out any longer. There are movies on that drive of women being tortured and murdered. Mayhew paused for a moment. Slowly, he sat back in his chair. He rested his elbows on the arms, folded his hands together in front of his stomach.
Okay.
I found them on my husband's computer. Well, hooked up to my husband's computer, an external hard drive that I found. She stopped to catch her breath. He didn't need to know the lengths Paul had gone to in order to hide the movies. He just needed to know that they were there. Claire pointed to the hard drive. That has movies that my husband watched of two different women being tortured and killed. The words hung between them. Claire could hear how awful they sounded. She said, I'm sorry, I just found them. I'm still... She didn't know what she still was. Shaken, grieving, furious, terrified, alone.
Just a sec.
Mayhew picked up the phone and punched in an extension.
Harv, I need you in here.
Before Claire could open her mouth again, another man came into the room. He was a shorter, wider version of Mayhew, but with the same type of shaggy mustache. Mayhew said,
Detective Harvey Falk, this is Mrs. Claire Scott.
Harvey gave Claire a nod.
Mayhew said, Hook this up for me, will you?
Harvey looked at the back of the drive, then he looked at the back of Mayhew's computer. He opened one of the desk drawers. There was a tangle of cables inside. He fished out the one he needed. Mayhew asked Claire,
Sure you don't want some water? Coffee?
Claire shook her head. She was scared that he wasn't taking her seriously. She was also scared that he was. They were down the rabbit hole now. There was no turning back. Harvey made quick work of the connections. He leaned past Mayhew and started typing on the keyboard. Claire looked around the room. Mayhew posed in the requisite framed photos of him shaking hands with city officials. A golfing trophy for the police league. Numbers from various marathons. She looked at the plaque on his desk. His first name was Jacob. Captain Jacob Mayhew.
Harvey said, There you go.
Thanks. Mayhew turned the keyboard back around as Harvey left the room. He straightened the mouse, then clicked on one of the files.
Let's see what we've got here.
Claire knew what he had. She looked away while he clicked open a handful of movies and watched them. The sound on his computer was turned off. All she could hear was Mayhew's steady breathing. She supposed you didn't get to the rank of captain by being surprised by what humanity could throw at you. Several minutes passed. Finally,
Mayhew let go of the mouse. He settled back in his chair again. He pulled at his mustache.
Well, I wish I could tell you I haven't seen stuff like this before. Much worse, being honest.
I can't believe. Claire could not articulate the things she could not believe.
Listen, ma'am. I know it's shocking. Trust me, the first time I saw this kind of stuff, I couldn't sleep for weeks, even though I knew it was fake.
Claire felt her heart leap. It's fake?
Well, yeah.
He stopped mid-chuckle.
It's called snuff porn. It's not real.
Are you sure? He turned the monitor so she could see for herself. One of the movies was frozen on screen. He pointed out,
"See this shadow here? That's the connection for the squib. Do you know what a squib is?"
Claire shook her head.
"It's a Hollywood thing, like a little plastic bladder filled with fake blood. They hide it under clothes or stick it on your back. The bad guy comes along and supposedly shoots you, or, in this case, machetes you, and then another guy off-camera presses a button and the squib explodes and the blood pours out."
He traced his finger along a shadow at the woman's side.
"This dark line here is the wire that connects to the squib. They got remote-controlled ones now, so I guess this was low budget, but..."
"I don't understand."
"It's fake. Not even good fake."
"But the girl..."
"Yeah, I know what you're thinking. She looks just like Anna Kilpatrick."
Claire hadn't been thinking that at all. But now that he'd said it, the resemblance was uncanny.
"Look it,"
Mayhew said.
"I know about your past. Your sister..."
Claire felt a warm sensation rush through her body.
"If I had a sister who disappeared like that, I'd probably be quick to make these kinds of connections, too."
"That's not what I..." Claire stopped herself. She had to appear calm. "This has nothing to do with my sister."
"You look at this girl in the movie and you think, brown hair, brown eyes, young, pretty, it's Anna Kilpatrick."
Claire's eyes went to the frozen image on screen. How had she not noticed before? Every time he said the girl's name, the resemblance became more obvious.
"Mrs. Scott, I'm going to be honest because I feel for you."
He patted his hand on the desk.
"I really feel for you."
Claire nodded for him to continue.
"This has to stay between us, all right? You can't tell nobody else."
She nodded again.
"The Kilpatrick girl."
He slowly shook his head side to side.
"They found blood in her car. A lot of blood. You know what I mean? The kind of blood that you need inside your body if you're going to stay alive."
"She's dead?" Claire felt a weight crushing her chest. She realized that somewhere, somehow, she had been hoping the girl was alive.
"Mrs. Scott, I really am sorry about your loss. And I'm sorry that you had to see this side of your husband. Men are pigs, all right? Take it from a pig who knows."
He tried to smile.
"Guys can look at some hardcore shit, excuse my language, but that doesn't mean they're into it or even want to do it. This kind of stuff is all over the internet, and as long as it's not kids, it's legal. And it's disgusting, but that's kind of what the internet is for, right?"
"But..." Claire grasped for words. The more she thought about it, the more the girl looked like Anna Kilpatrick. "Don't you think it's an odd coincidence?"
"No such thing," Mayhew said. "There's something called the law of truly large numbers, Get a big enough size sample, outrageous things are bound to happen.
Claire felt her eyes widen, her lips part in a textbook example of shock.
Is something wrong?
She worked to return her expression to some semblance of normal. He might as well be quoting Paul, which begged the question, had he ever met Paul?
Mrs. Scott?
I'm sorry. Claire forced some calm into her voice. It's just, the way you said it, I hadn't thought about it that way, but now that I hear it, it makes sense. She had to clear her throat before she could continue. Where did you hear that phrase? The law of truly large numbers? He smiled again.
I don't know. Probably a fortune cookie.
She tried to steady herself. Every ounce of her being was telling her something was wrong. Was Mayhew lying? Or was he trying to protect her from something more dangerous at play? She asked, Can you tell me why Agent Nolan was at my house yesterday?
Mayhew huffed out some air. Being honest with you again? I got no idea. Those FBI guys are like flies around our cases. The minute it looks like we've got something good, they snatch it away so they can get all the credit.
They can take a case away from you? They don't have to be asked?
Nope. They just walk in and take over.
He unplugged the hard drive.
Thanks for bringing this in. Of course I'm going to have my people look at it, but like I said, I've seen this kind of thing before.
Claire realized he was dismissing her. She stood up. Thank you.
Mayhew stood up too. The best thing you can do for yourself is forget about this, all right? Your husband was a good guy. You had a solid marriage, almost 20 years, and you still loved each other. That's something to hold on to.
Claire nodded. She was feeling sick again. Mayhew placed his hand on the hard drive.
Looks like you took this right from his computer.
Sorry?
The drive. It was connected directly to his computer, right?
Claire didn't hesitate. Yes.
Good.
Mayhew put his hand to her back and led her out of the office.
We wouldn't want any copies floating around, like on a backup or another computer.
I checked. It was only on the hard drive.
What about his laptop? Didn't Quinn say something about Paul's laptop?
I already checked it. She had no idea where the damn thing even was. There's nothing else.
All right.
His fingers curved around her waist as he steered her toward the last corridor.
You let me know if anything else comes up. Just give me a call and I'll head right over and take it off your hands.
Claire nodded. Thank you for your help.
Anytime.
He walked her across the small lobby and held open the glass door. Claire held onto the railing as she navigated her way down the stairs. The overhead lights sent a glimmer through the rain as she crossed the parking lot. The entire time, she felt Mayhew's eyes on her. She didn't turn until she had reached the Tesla. The doorway was empty. Mayhew was gone. Was she being paranoid? Claire wasn't sure about anything anymore. She opened the car door. She was about to get in when she saw the note on the windshield. She recognized Adam Quinn's handwriting. I really need those files. Please don't make me do this the hard way. A.Q. Chapter 6 Lydia lay on the couch with her head on Rick's lap. Two dogs were on the floor in front of her, a cat was curled into her side, and the hamster was either running a marathon on its wheel, or the parakeet in Dee's room was scraping its beak on the side of the cage. The fish in the 50-gallon tank were blissfully quiet. Rick absently ran his fingers through her hair. They were watching the 10 o'clock news because they were both too pathetic to stay up until 11. The police had released a composite drawing of a man seen in the vicinity of Anna Kilpatrick's disabled car. The drawing was almost laughably vague. The guy was either tall or medium height. His eyes were blue or green. His hair was black or brown. There were no tattoos or identifying marks. His own mother probably wouldn't recognize him. The report cut to a taped interview with Congressman Johnny Jackson. The Kilpatrick family was from his district, so by law, he had to milk their personal tragedy for every political ounce possible. He droned on about law and order for a few seconds, but when the reporter tried to pull Jackson into speculation about the girl's well-being, the man fell uncharacteristically silent. Anyone who'd ever read an airport paperback knew that the chances of finding the missing girl alive dwindled with each passing hour. Lydia closed her eyes so she wouldn't see images of the Kilpatrick family. Their haggard expressions had become painfully familiar. She could tell they were slowly coming to accept that their little girl would not be coming home. Pretty soon, a year would pass. Then another year. Then the family would quietly mark the decade anniversary. Then 2 decades. Then more. Children would be born. Grandchildren. Marriage vows would be made and broken. And behind every single event would lurk the shadow of this missing 16-year-old girl. Every once in a while, a Google alert on Lydia's computer found a story that mentioned Julia's name. Usually it was because a body had been found in the Athens area, and the reporter had reached into the archives to find past open cases that might be relevant. Of course, the body was never identified as Julia Carroll, or Abigail Ellis, or Samantha Findlay, or any of the dozens of women who had gone missing since then. There was a depressingly large number of hits for missing girl plus University of Georgia. Add in rape, and the tally climbed into the millions. Had Claire performed these same types of searches? Did she feel the same kind of nausea when an alert came up that a body had been found? Lydia had never checked the internet for information on her baby sister. If Claire had a Facebook page or Instagram account, she did not want to see it. Everything that had to do with Claire had to do with Paul. The association was too painful to invite onto her computer screen. And honestly, the anguish of losing Claire was almost more overwhelming than losing Julia. Whatever had happened to her older sister had been a tragedy. Her rift with Claire had been a choice. Claire's choice. And Helen's, too. The last time Lydia had talked to her mother, Helen had said, "Don't make me choose between you and your sister." To which Lydia had responded, "I think you already have." Though Lydia hadn't spoken to her mother since, she still kept tabs on her. The last time she checked the Athens-Clark County tax records, Helen still lived in their old house on Boulevard, just west of campus. The Banner Herald ran a nice story when Helen retired from the library after 40 years of service. Her colleagues had said that their grammar would never be the same. The obituary for Helen's second husband mentioned that she had 3 daughters, which Lydia thought was nice until she realized that someone else had probably written it. Dee hadn't made the list because they didn't know she existed. Lydia would likely never remedy the situation. She could not bear the humiliation of having her daughter meet people who held her mother in such low regard. Lydia often wondered if her family ever looked online for her. She doubted Helen used Google. She had always been a strictly Dewey Decimal kind of gal. There were so many different sides of Helen that Lydia had known, the young, fun-loving mother who organized dance contests and Sweet Valley High sleepovers, the much-feared, cerebral librarian who humiliated the school board when they tried to ban Go Ask Alice from the library, the devastated, paralyzed woman who drank herself to sleep in the middle of the day after her oldest daughter went missing. And then there was the Helen who warned, "Don't make me choose," when she had clearly already made her choice. Could Lydia blame them for not believing her about Paul? What Claire had said at the cemetery today was mostly true. Lydia had stolen from them. She had lied. She had cheated. She had exploited their emotions. She had banked on their fear of losing another child and basically extorted them for drug money. But that was the thing. Lydia had been a junkie. All of her crimes had been in the service of getting high, which begged the obvious question that Helen and Claire had apparently never bothered to ask. What could Lydia possibly gain from lying about Paul? They hadn't even let her tell the story. Separately, she had tried to tell each of them about riding with Paul in the Miata, the song on the radio, the way Paul had touched her knee, what had happened next. And they had each had the same response. "I don't want to hear it." "Time to wake up." Rick muted the TV when a commercial came on. He slipped on his reading glasses and asked, "What is the groundnut better known as?" Lydia carefully rolled onto her back so the cat wouldn't be disturbed.
"The peanut."
"Correct."
He shuffled through the Trivial Pursuit cards. They were cramming for the Westerly PTO parent-teacher trivia night. Lydia barely had 2 years of college. Rick had 3. They took a perverse pleasure in beating the doctors and lawyers of the Westerly Chosen. Rick asked, "Who was buried in an Argentine cemetery under the name Maria Maggi?" "Eva Perón. Give me something harder." Rick shuffled through the cards again.
"Where is the tallest mountain on Earth?"
Lydia put her hand over her eyes so she could concentrate.
"You said tallest, not highest elevation, so it can't be Everest."
She made some thinking noises that caused the dogs to stir. The cat started making biscuits on her stomach. She could hear the clock ticking in the kitchen. Finally, Rick said,
"Think ukulele."
She peeked through her fingers.
"Hawaii?"
"Mauna Kea."
"Did you know the answer?"
"I'm gonna say yes, because you have no way of knowing."
She reached up and pretended to smack his cheek. He bit at her hand.
"Tell me what your sister's like."
Lydia had already told him about surprising Claire at the cemetery that afternoon, though she'd left out the unseemly bit about squatting over Paul's grave.
"She's exactly how I thought she would be." "You can't just say she's a mother and leave it at that."
"Why not?" The words came out sharper than Lydia intended. The cat sensed her tension and moved to the arm of the couch. "She's still thin and beautiful. Obviously, she works out all the time. Her outfit cost more than my first car. I bet she has her manicurist on speed dial." Rick stared down at her.
"That's all there is to her? A gym membership and designer clothes?"
"Of course not." Lydia bristled because Claire was still her sister. "She's complicated. People look at her and they see how beautiful she is, but they don't realize that underneath she's smart and funny and..." Her voice trailed off. Was Claire still smart and funny? After Julia disappeared and Helen checked out, Lydia had taken over the mothering responsibilities. She was the one who made sure Claire got to school on time, had lunch money and clean clothes. She was the one Claire had always confided in. They were best friends, until Paul had forced them apart. She told Rick,
She's quiet.
She hates confrontation.
She'll walk halfway around the world to avoid an argument.
So she's adopted?
Lydia slapped his arm. Trust me, she was very sneaky. It might look like she was agreeing with you, but then she'd run off and do whatever the hell she wanted.
Lydia waited for another comment, but Rick held his tongue.
She said, "Before the rift, I used to think I was the only person in the world who really understood her."
"And now?"
Lydia tried to remember exactly what Claire had told her in the cemetery.
"She said I don't know a damn thing about her."
"And she's right.
I don't know Claire with Paul."
"You think she's changed that much?"
"Who knows?" Lydia said. "She was 13 when Julia went missing. We all dealt with it in our own way. You know what I did, and what happened to my mom and dad. Claire's response was to make herself invisible. She just agreed with everybody, at least on the surface. She never caused any problems. She made solid grades in school. She was co-captain of the cheerleading team. She tagged along with all the popular girls."
"Well, that doesn't sound invisible to me."
"I'm saying it wrong, then." Lydia searched for a better way to explain. "She was always holding herself back. She was co-captain, not captain. She could have dated the quarterback, but she dated his brother instead. She could have been top in her class, but she'd purposely turn in a paper late or miss an assignment so she'd fall closer to the middle. She would know about Mauna Kea, but she would say Everest because winning would bring too much attention."
"Why?"
"I don't know," Lydia said, not because she didn't know, but because she didn't know a way to explain it that made sense. No one understood striving for second place. It was un-American. She just wanted peace, I guess. Being a teenager is so hard. Julia and I had two great parents growing up. All Claire had was turmoil."
Rick asked, "So what did she see in Paul?"
"He wasn't exactly in the margins. His obituary made him out to be a pretty successful guy." Lydia had seen the photo in Paul's obit. Claire had somehow managed to put pearls on the proverbial pig.
"He wasn't that way when she met him. He was an obnoxious grad student in thick glasses. He wore black socks with sandals. He laughed through his nose. He was really, really smart, maybe even a genius, but he was maybe a 5, and Claire's always been a solid 10.
Lydia remembered the first time she'd met Paul Scott. Her only thought was that Claire could do so much better. But the fact was that Claire had never wanted to do better.
Lydia said, "She always flirted with the good-looking popular guys, but she went home with the geeky ones who practically slobbered with gratitude. I think they made her feel safe."
"What's wrong with feeling safe?" "Because the way Paul made her feel safe was by pushing everybody else out of the way. He was her savior. He made her think that he was all she needed. She stopped talking to her friends. She stopped calling me as much. She didn't go home anymore to visit Mom and Dad. He isolated her."
"Sounds like a classic abuser."
"As far as I know, he never hit her or even raised his voice at her. He just kept her."
"Like a bird in a gilded cage?"
"Sort of," Lydia said, "because it was more than that. He was obsessed with her. He'd look at her through the window when she was in class. He'd leave notes on her car. She'd come home, and there would be a rose on her doorstep."
"That's not romantic."
"Not if you do it every single day."
Rick didn't have a response to that. When they were out in public, he was
always touching her, stroking her hair, holding her hand, kissing her cheek. It wasn't sweet. It was creepy.
Well, Rick put on his diplomatic tone. Maybe she liked the attention. I mean, she married him and stayed married to him for almost 20 years.
It's more like she gave in.
To
the wrong type of guy.
Which is?
Someone she could never be passionate about or lose sleep over or worry about running around. He was safe because she would never really give all of herself to him.
I don't know, babe. 20 years is a long time to put up with somebody you don't like.
Lydia thought about how devastated Claire had looked at the cemetery. She certainly seemed to be grieving. Then again, Claire was always really good at behaving exactly the way people expected her to behave. Not out of duplicity, but out of self-preservation. She said, "Back when I was thin and beautiful, guys like Paul were always hanging around. I made fun of them. I teased them. I used them. And they let me use them because being around me meant that they weren't losers."
Damn, babe, that's harsh.
It's the truth. I'm sorry to be blunt about it, but girls don't like guys who are doormats. Especially pretty girls, because there's no novelty to it. Guys are hitting on them all of the time. They can't walk down the street or order a coffee or stand on a corner without some idiot making a comment about how attractive they are. And the women smile because it's easier than telling them to go fuck themselves. And less dangerous. Because if a man rejects a woman, she goes home and cries for a few days. If a woman rejects a man, he can rape and kill her.
I hope you're not giving Dee this excellent dating advice.
She'll learn it on her own soon enough. Lydia could still remember what it felt like back when she was fronting the band. Men had fought for the privilege of accommodating her. She never had to open a door for herself. She never had to buy a drink, or a bump, or a baggie. She said she wanted something, and it was placed in front of her before she could finish the sentence. She told Rick,
"The world stops for you when you're pretty.
That's why women spend billions on crap for their faces. Their whole life, they're the center of attention. People want to be around them just because they're attractive. Their jokes are funnier. Their lives are better, and then, suddenly, they get bags under their eyes, or they put on a little weight, and no one cares about them anymore. They cease to exist."
"You're using a mighty broad brush to paint a whole bunch of people."
"Back in high school, did you ever see a guy get shoved into a locker? Or watch someone slap a lunch tray out of his hand?" Rick said nothing, probably because he had been the one terrorizing the poor kid. Imagine if that guy dated the homecoming queen. That's what it was like when Paul started dating Claire. You could totally see what he was getting out of it, but what was in it for her? Rick stared at the muted television as he thought it over.
"I guess I see your point. But there's more to people than how they look."
"But you only get to know somebody because you like what you see." He smiled down at her.
"I like what I see."
Lydia wondered how many chins she had from lying on her back and whether or not her root showed in the glow of the television.
"What on earth could you possibly see?" "The woman I want to spend the rest of my life with."
Rick put his hand on her stomach.
"This belly you're always complaining about? This is where Dee spent the first 9 months of her life."
He pressed his palm to her chest.
"This heart is the kindest, gentlest heart I've ever known."
He let his fingers trace up toward her neck.
"And this is where your beautiful voice is made."
He lightened the pressure as he touched her lips.
These are the softest lips I've ever kissed.
He touched her eyelids.
These eyes see straight through my bullshit.
He stroked back her hair.
This head is full of thoughts that surprise me and enlighten me and make me laugh.
Lydia guided his hand back to her breasts.
What about these? Hours of pleasure.
Kiss me before I say something stupid. He leaned down and kissed her mouth. She wrapped her hand around the back of his neck. Dee was spending the night at Bella's. Tomorrow was Sunday. They could sleep in. Maybe have a second go-round. Her cell phone chirped in the other room. Rick knew better than to ask her to ignore the phone when Dee was away. She told him, "Keep going without me, I'll catch up." Lydia picked her way past the dogs and a pile of laundry as she made her way into the kitchen. Her purse was in a chair. She dug around in the bag for several seconds before spotting her phone on the counter. There was a new text.
"She all right?"
Rick was standing in the doorway. "She probably forgot her math book again." Lydia swiped her thumb across the screen. There was a text from a blocked number. The message listed an unfamiliar address in Dunwoody. Rick asked, "What's wrong?" Lydia stared at the address, wondering if the text was sent by mistake. She ran a small business. She didn't have the luxury of clocking out. The voicemail at work gave her cell phone number. The work number was on the side of her van, alongside a photo of a giant yellow lab that reminded her of the dog her father had rescued after Julia was gone.
"Liddy," Rick said. "Who is it?"
"It's Claire," Lydia said, because she felt it with every ounce of her being. "My sister needs me." Chapter 7. Claire sat in her office because she couldn't stand being in Paul's anymore. Her desk was an antique Chippendale secretary that she'd had painted a soft eggshell white. The walls were pale gray. The rug on the floor was patterned with yellow roses. The overstuffed chair and ottoman were covered in a muted lilac velvet. A simple chandelier hung overhead, but Claire had replaced the clear crystals with amethysts that spotted the wall in a purple prism when the sun hit it just right. Paul never came into her space. He only stood at the doorway, afraid that his penis would fall off if he touched anything pastel. She looked down at the note Adam Quinn had left on the car. "I really need those files. Please don't make me do this the hard way. A.Q." Claire had stared at the words so long that she could see them when her eyes were closed. The hard way. That was certainly a threat, which was surprising because Adam had no reason to threaten her. What exactly was the hard way? Was he going to send some goons around to rough her up? Was there some sort of sexual innuendo intended? Her dalliances with Adam had been a little rough sometimes, but that was mostly because of the illicit nature of their affair. There had been no romantic hotel rooms, just quickies up against the wall at a Christmas party, a second time at a golf tournament, and once in the bathroom inside the Quinn and Scott offices. Honestly, their clandestine phone calls and secret texts had been more titillating than the actual acts. Still, Claire couldn't help wondering which files Adam meant. Work files or porn files? Because Adam and Paul had shared everything, from a dorm room in college to the same insurance agent. And Claire supposed she belonged on that list of shared items. But who the hell knew whether Paul had figured that out? Then again, what exactly had Claire figured out? She had looked at the movies again. All of them, this time. Claire had rigged up Paul's laptop in the garage so she wouldn't have to sit in his office. Halfway through the first series of movies, she'd found herself somewhat anesthetized to the violence. Habituation, Paul would have explained. But fuck Paul and his stupid explanations. With her newfound distance, Claire was able to see that each movie series told the same linear story. At first, the chained girls were fully clothed. Subsequent installments revealed the masked man slowly cutting or slicing away their clothing to reveal leather bustiers and crotchless panties that they had obviously been forced to wear. Sometimes their heads were covered in a black hood made of a light fabric that showed their desperate inhalations as they gasped for breath. As the story progressed, the violence ramped up. There was beating, then whipping, then cutting, then burning them with a branding iron, then the cattle prod. The girls were unmasked toward the end. The first woman's face was exposed for two of the movies before she was butchered. The girl who looked like Anna Kilpatrick was hooded until the very last movie on Paul's secret hard drive. Claire had closely studied the girl's face. There was no way of telling whether or not she was looking at Anna Kilpatrick. Claire had even pulled up a photo from the Kilpatrick family's Facebook page. She had positioned them side by side and still been unsure. Then, she had clicked the play button and watched the last movie all the way through. Claire had the sound on at first, but she couldn't take the screaming. The man entered wearing the same unnerving rubber mask. He had the machete, but he didn't use it to kill the girl. He used it to rape her. Claire had nearly been sick again. She'd had to take a walk down the driveway and up again just to get air back into her lungs. Was it real? Captain Mayhew had claimed there was a wire running down the girl's side that controlled the release of fake blood. Claire had found a magnifying glass in one of Paul's drawers. All that she could see at the girl's side were pieces of flayed skin sticking out like broken glass. There was certainly no wire on the floor, and surely if there was an operator standing off-camera with a control unit, the wire would have to be connected somehow. Next, Claire had searched the internet for information on squibs, but as far as she could tell, all of them were remotely controlled. She had even done a general search for snuff porn movies, but Claire had been terrified to click on any of the links. The descriptions were too unsettling. Live beheadings, cannibalism, necrophilia, something called death rape. She'd tried Wikipedia, but gathered that most recorded murders were frenetic and amateurish, not carefully framed and following a set progression. So, did that support Mayhew's assertion that the movies were fake? Or did it mean that Paul had found the best snuff porn, the same way he found the best golf clubs or the best leather for his custom-made office chair? Claire hadn't been able to take any more. She had left the garage. She had gone inside the house. She had taken two Valium. She had held her head under the kitchen faucet until the cold water had numbed her skin. If only she could numb her brain. Despite the pills, her mind would not stop racing with conspiracies. Were these awful movies the files that Adam wanted? Was he in cahoots with mustachioed Captain Mayhew? Was that why Adam was at the police station? Is that why Mayhew had been so strange at the end of their meeting, going out of his way to confirm that there were no more copies of the movies when he'd just told Claire that they weren't real and she shouldn't worry about them? What if they really were fake, and the girl wasn't Anna Kilpatrick, but an actress. And Adam was at the police station tonight because he had a key to the house. And Mayhew knew about the law of truly large numbers because he'd seen